Hey friends, I hope you're doing well. Thanks so much for stopping by for episode 7 and 8 of the Chase the Peace podcast, where my brother stopped by to have a conversation related to his challenges with drug and alcohol addiction. And we'll jump into that conversation here in just a minute. But before we do that, I wanted to share some stats related to drug and alcohol addiction. This is per the American Addiction Centers based on 2022 data. 46.8 million Americans, that's roughly 17% of the population, battled a substance use disorder in the past year. Roughly 10.5% of Americans had an alcohol use disorder in the past year. 21.5 million American adults suffered from both a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder, what the American Addiction Center calls co-occurring disorders, in the past year. Those are overwhelming numbers, which chances are you know someone that has battled some type of addiction related to a substance. My ask of you, send this conversation to them so they don't feel alone. I'm grateful you stopped by. We'll jump into the conversation. Jason, you're my first family member that I've hosted on the Chase the Peace podcast, and I couldn't be more honored that you're here. I've heard you tell your story. It's really compelling and powerful. So thank you for being here
and, very welcome.
And spending some time here. Before I ask anything about your journey, help us get to know you. Help us get to know Jason.
I guess I'll start with the fact that I'm 48 years old. As of a few days ago, I have 3 kids. I've been married twice, and that plays in a little bit to some of the stuff we'll be talking about. Divorced twice, too. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law for 20 years, which seems crazy. I'm an addict and an alcoholic in long-term recovery, which pretty much in a lot of ways colors a lot of my thinking today. Not the alcoholism or the addiction, but the recovery, you know, pretty much colors my thinking about just about everything I do on a daily basis.
We're here to talk about redemption as it relates to addiction, your addiction specifically, which can't necessarily feel like super comfortable. So I'll ask you what my counselor asks me every time we start. How does it feel to be here?
It feels good to be here. I mean, it feels good to be, first of all, to be alive. You know, there were a lot of times in my journey where that was not necessarily a given. I have been to a lot of funerals. I've lost a lot of friends to, you know, call it, put it under the umbrella of mental health, but you know, all things, depression, suicide. I have friends who have drank themselves to death. I have friends who have died from overdoses, a lot of those since the opioid epidemic. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive. You know, more than that, I'm grateful to be sober and able to talk about that stuff. And, you know, you mentioned in terms of my level of comfort talking about it, I do feel very much that my story is a tool that can help people. One of the driving themes of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the 12-step programs is that to keep what we've got, we got to give it away. And so for me, every time I tell my story with a mind and a heart towards maybe helping somebody else, I'm ensuring my own, you know, continued sobriety. So it's actually a pleasure to be able to talk about it. I do that a lot anyway, mostly with other like-minded recovered alcoholics. But there's a part of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about the things that we'll see that start to come true in our lives as we make our way through the steps. And one of the first ones in this list of promises, which have come to be known as the 9th step promises, is we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, because it's our greatest tool. It's our greatest asset as people that are trying to spread the message.
Take me back to where the journey began for you.
My story is obviously pretty long, and it has, you know, definite seasons, chapters, or maybe even acts would be the right word, because you know, you have these periods of time, and my story kind of can be broken up into two main parts. You know, there was a period of time where I really struggled with drugs. That was my main problem. And then kind of a separate bottom, rock bottom, for lack of a better word, that I dealt with alcohol. So starting at the very beginning of all that, I was just in a unique place when I was 18 years old, have kind of a natural rebellious streak, questioning authority, all that kind of thing. Anyway, you know, the church that we were in at the time went through the split. Of course, you were there. But the effect that it had on me, due to just all, you know, all the stuff that went on and the hard feelings that existed between members of this, of the leadership of this church, was that all of, you know, basically my entire peer group was not allowed to communicate with me or hang out with me. I mean, they still did because they were teenagers too, but it was never, it was always something that had to be kind of like, it was clandestine. It wasn't something that could be out in the open. And so my peer group kind of just evaporated overnight. And to a certain extent, you know, I was kind of at an age where I already had some misgivings about the church and organized religion. I was asking the questions that a lot of people do on their path towards a faith that's beyond the Sunday school version, like a more true, genuine faith that has considered all the evidence. I was just kind of starting to get into that part of my life when all this happened. So it was just so easy to lump it all in together, have this big resentment against, and I didn't really just make the distinction in my mind between the church, God, religion, all of it. That was kind of the bad guy, because I saw the way it had treated Dad and the way that the effect that it had had on him, how hurt he was personally. And I just decided, you know, none of this is true. You know, they say these things, and we say that we believe these things, but we don't. You know, it's when it comes to how we interact with each other on a day-to-day basis, we do what everybody else does, which is look out for ourselves. And you know, there's just no difference, was the way that I looked at it. And, it, you know, it was a clumsy 18-year-old kind of worldview that I hadn't really developed very much. But needless to say, I was a lot more open to, you know, to alternatives. I had jettisoned basically the way that I had ordered my world for 18 years. And, you know, there's going to be various things that are seeking to fill that void. And one of the main things that I was looking for was acceptance. I just wanted to be liked. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted, for lack of a better word, to be thought of as cool. And so when somebody suggested to me that I worked with, that we could go back to his house after work and smoke some pot and listen to some music, I kind of acted like, yeah, you know, of course I've done that before. When I really, frankly, didn't even know, he used some terminology. I think he said, hey, man, do you burn? And I was like, yes, I do. I had no idea what he meant, but I kind of figured it out from context clues during our shift. You know, we went over to his house. At this point, the idea of rebelling, drugs and alcohol, all of that stuff is just kind of the same. I haven't really even considered or been exposed to the reason that people do these things. And also, more importantly, for what happens down the road, why that's dangerous, you know, why it's like playing with fire. But then we, you know, we went out to his house and listened to Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, from beginning to the end. I had heard the name Pink Floyd. I had no idea what it was or what it meant, that it was this, you know, kind of blues, jazz, rock and roll band that played this really kind of ethereal music. I didn't know any of that. And so, you know, I got high for the first time that night, and we listened to that album. And I just remember thinking that I've been lied to, you know, that something like this was out there. And not only had it not been, you know, shared with me by the, you know, quote unquote adults or the authorities in my life, but I had actively been told to avoid it because it was such an unequivocally good thing, you know, looked at on an island, you know, on its own without any, you know, thought given to where it would lead. At that point, I knew why people did what they did. It made you feel really good. It made you forget all the other stuff. You know, there was almost this kind of spiritual sense to it, like a connectedness to something bigger than you is the only way I can think of to describe the music and the effect of the pot and the music. And, you know, one of the things that I've read and heard a lot during my journey in recovery is that that is a defining characteristic, seemingly, of pretty much every alcoholic or addict. You know, most people, normal people, earth people, as we call them, they remember like their first kiss with really clear, you know, with a level of clarity, like it's still there. Their first their first girlfriend, their first prom, the first time they had sex, you know, all those kinds of things. If you talk to an addict, almost across the board, we can all remember that very first time where we got it, you know, where we had that experience. And magical is the word that almost everybody uses. Scientists theorize that one of the things that causes addiction in the first place, the genetic component, is that we experience those things differently from other people. It has a more profound effect that's more connected to memory or something that just makes it more relevant. I don't know if any of that's true, but that was my experience. At that point, I just had a massive curiosity about drugs, you know, drugs and alcohol and the effect that they had on your brain. I was truly in a scientific, like, curiosity kind of sense. I was completely blown away that a molecule could have such a profound effect on the way, you know, we experience the world around us, because our perception, our experience is everything. It's who we are. You know, it means to be human, our sentience, the filters through which we see and hear and experience the world. And the fact that those things are so easy to change, it was a fascinating prospect to me. And so I just wanted to know what everything felt like. You know, this was such a profound, earth-shattering thing. Surely there were other experiences out there that I hadn't had. And if I'd been lied to about this, and I probably had been lied to about a lot of things, if marijuana is this safe feeling, it just wasn't the kind of experience that I would have ever thought could lead to a bad place. That's how it all got started. And from there, progressed on to other things. But mostly for a long time, it was just, you know, marijuana and alcohol. I think at some point it was an older brother of a friend that introduced me to cocaine, and that was a departure from the, you know, relative safety of marijuana. And it was definitely different in the sense that the way that you felt, it just was a completely different thing. Like, I kind of got it with that this is a thing that is very dangerous and should be avoided. The purely feel good drugs, you know, there's no experience there. There's no spirituality. It's like just pressing a button in your brain but you know, that's kind of how I got started. And for a long time, just kind of stayed like that. It didn't have any effect on my ability to do, you know, school or to achieve the goals that I wanted to achieve. There was a sense that I was always kind of operating at like 87%, you know, and I didn't like that. But, you know, I was a high achiever. I was smart. I could read quickly and understand things very easily. So I was able to excel as a student, you know, without having to make any changes to my lifestyle. And then, of course, I got to Athens and that, you know, just throw fuel on the fire. But at that time, it was all still fun, you know, just having a good time, young people doing stupid, reckless things. I did at some point while I was in Athens, especially once I got to law school, I did start to notice that I was losing control with certain of the drugs, in that I would do really ill-advised, impulsive things either to acquire them, or I would like shun other activities that used to be more meaningful and more important to me to do that alone or with, you know, a small group of people. I'd make bad decisions as far as academic things that were coming up, tests or finals that were coming up, and knowing that I had a certain amount of time to study to get something done, and then the opportunity would present itself to do cocaine, say, just to use an example, and I would jump on it really without even thinking of the consequences. There were a lot of times where I thought that the jig was up. I've done it. I'm going to fail out of law school, or I'm going to fail out of college, or I'm going to get, you know, I'm not going to get this job because I tested positive there were a lot of moments where I felt like it was all over. The party was over, but it just never happened. I just always somehow just kind of worked out. And so then it's really easy to rationalize after the fact that you're doing fine.
So you're talking about like a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, from being 18 years old to going through undergraduate to law school, where you were just, you experimented with all these things. You had hints of like making choices in the direction of drugs or alcohol rather than, you know, some of the responsibilities you had, but you just kept getting by.
Yeah.
Like it never caught up with you during any of those seasons. I'm curious to know when did you actually feel like I've lost control of this?
I would say it was after I was married and had graduated from law school and was working. So now you take all of those things, college, law school, you know, all the way back to 18, that entire period of time is very limited in terms of access to money. So I would run out of money long before I could really get a problematic amount of any one substance. But once I graduated from law school and was working, that was no longer an issue. And this was before I had kids. I really did a lot of drinking and I did a lot of cocaine at that time. I knew by the time I was working as a lawyer that I had lost control of cocaine. A lot of times the way we say that is I was using it against my will. There would be times that I really didn't want to be doing it. But I knew that I would be so tortured by the decision not to, if I decided not to, that I may as well just go ahead and get it. Cocaine is a really weird thing because it's a stimulant. It's not something that creates a physical addiction, but it is a very strong psychological addiction that operates a little bit like, I don't know, the way I felt about it when I knew that I was going to be getting it or that it was going to be a part of whatever I was doing on a weekend. It would be like waking up, like when you're the closest thing for an adult to waking up on Christmas morning, you know, it just made the whole day better. Even if, you know, before you had it and were using it, it's just really strange how that worked. And, you know, on the flip side of that, any event where that wasn't going to be a part of it was just kind of like ho-hum. And that's where alcohol really started to be a problem is every time I drank and lowered my inhibition just enough, I became like a, you know, cocaine seeking missile. That was the gears in my mind shifted because I so often did them together that when I started to drink, my brain was like, you know, this is good. But, and that's where you get into kind of the reckless behavior of an impulsive behavior of acquiring and using and, you know, mate, let's say you're at an event with a bunch of people who that's not their thing at all. But you show up, you start drinking and then, you know, you somehow get that in your possession. Either you leave for a few minutes or an hour and then come back. And then suddenly you're doing something in front of people that are not okay with it. And, you know, that's obviously poor judgment or the act of driving to go get something. If you've had something to drink, you know, particularly once you've got it and you're driving back, you know, drinking and driving, first of all, is a terrible idea. Drinking and driving with something else in the car, that's a felony, even worse judgment. And all of these things can be amplified by how much you've had to drink. So the level of recklessness that you're willing, the extent to which you're willing to go is greater, let's say, when you're drinking than it would be otherwise. Once I had made up my mind that I wanted to do something like that, it's like once I made up my mind that that was going to happen tonight, it was going to happen at some point that night. If it wasn't until 2 or 3 in the morning, it was going to happen. You know, no amount of money that I would have to spend would be too great. No distance that I would have to drive. There were times I wouldn't think anything about driving an hour one way and then an hour back if once I had gotten the notion in my mind. And that stuff all starts to feel a little out of control. It also started to feel a little bit out of control because the more of that drug that you consume, you kind of lose touch with reality, you know, the longer that you've been awake and become increasingly paranoid, thinking that you hear voices or you see like flashing lights outside or something like that. And those are interesting effects in that once you've gotten to that level, from that point going forward, it doesn't matter how much or how little of the substance that you consume, those side effects are there immediately. It's interesting how the drugs of abuse work like that. It might take you forever to experience a certain side effect, but once you get there, it happens very easily. The DTs are like that with alcohol. I personally was not one of the people genetically. Well, you know, I take that back. I think my hands would shake with alcohol, but there's a certain number of people that get DTs and a certain number of people, percentage of people that don't. But if you're one of those people, you can go out and just have a relapse that lasts for one night, and you'll immediately go into DTs once you stop. Those kinds of side effects are accumulating. I'm starting to do more and more reckless things to get the drugs. Alcohol at this point is primarily beer, but it's every day, every night, I should say. 10 or 12 beers every night, and that was just normal. And I do remember there were a few times that I started to think, you know, I can't remember the last time I didn't have at least 6 beers, you know, after I came home from work. You know, I didn't like these things, but it always felt like a problem that could be kicked. You know, you could just kick the can. You know, this obviously is not acceptable, but at some point, you know, I'll reach a point where I'm ready to change, and, you know, I can stop anytime I want, you know, kind of thing. When the reasons for using really changed, and it wasn't so much about having fun, I know exactly when that happened. It's when we lost the baby. You know, we went to find out the sex of the baby, and instead of finding out the sex of the baby, they couldn't find a heartbeat. So they tried to find the heartbeat and did an ultrasound, and the baby was stillborn. You know, the crazy thing about that is that happened, and I, to this day, and I have never talked about it. It was just she was sedated, and it was just me. And all of a sudden, I'm making these decisions like, do you want to do a normal burial and all this stuff? Do you want to have a birth certificate with a name? It just felt like too small for the moment. I felt like I'm not up for any of this. She let me hold the baby, and I can tell you, at 20 weeks, they are every bit, you know, of a human being, you know, down to the little, you know, folds in the eyelids. I just remember being so like affected by that you can make out all this detail even at 20 weeks. You know, I now know that that was trauma. I was experiencing trauma. When it was over, we just never wanted to talk about it again. All of that together, combined with the fact that it kind of changed my worldview to believe that it made more sense to me to think that there wasn't a God at all. And that that's why tragic things happen, is because we're just part of the natural world, and that's it. That's all there is. There's not any more significance than that. That was like my whole life. You know, religion was such a big part of it, in God and Christ, and whether it's the faith itself or the history of the faith, to all of a sudden feel like all of that is just a big nothing burger, you know, I didn't really realize it at the time. It was like the ground underneath me had just been taken away. And I now believe that the thing that my family's lives essentially were dedicated to, in my heart of hearts, like I would never say this. I wasn't the kind of person that liked to create waves that way, but I sincerely felt that it was just all a big myth. And my whole family buys into it, and I feel so bad for them, and I feel so bad for me. And I don't even know how to say that this is where I'm at and how lonely that felt. It felt like the intellectually consistent conclusion that I must come to, and it shattered everything else that had always been important to me. And I couldn't really talk about it other than maybe some kind of smug self-satisfaction that I'm smarter than everybody else. And, you know, oh, poor you, you've got to have your religion to cope. And I don't need that. I'm strong enough and smart enough to be intellectually consistent and acknowledge, you know, there's nothing out there. And I really felt that. That's what's weird. There's so many things in my life where it's really hard for me to separate what I actually believed from what I wanted you to believe that I believed. I was so consumed with perception and how I was perceived, or what I wanted you to think about me. This was something that I honestly believed in my heart of hearts. It was like just all my instincts tuned to the wrong channel, and it made sense in a really, you know, it was awful. You know, it was an awful period of my life. However, it also meant that nothing matters. You know, if nothing matters, you know, nothing matters. It was I would describe this time in my life as when things really took off in a destructive way. And it's almost like I didn't have the terminology at the time, but I was a nihilist. You know, a nihilist believe that the only meaning life has is meaning that you give it. I just didn't think that, you know, who cares how many drugs I use? Yeah, we conventionally think of people who are addicted to substances as a bad thing. But, you know, I'm not that bad of a guy. You know, there's no God. There's no overarching value system or truth that exists in the world. So if this is the way I choose to live my life, so be it. You know, I literally thought that I wasn't doing anything wrong, other than it became very important to me at that time for family and the people that I love to not know any of this. I didn't want anyone to know that, you know, I saw myself as an atheist and that I had this lifestyle that I knew nobody would agree with. But I honestly didn't think that I was doing anything wrong. You know, I'm not hurting anybody. But now is about the time that I did start to hurt people. There's like about a 7-year period that's almost like a bite was taken out of my life. I think I alluded to this in the talk that you heard. I lost my job and, you know, untethered from any kind of decent worldview, I really did free myself up to live how I wanted to live. And the results were spectacularly bad. This is when I, you know, lost my job, was doing all kinds of sneaky bad things that, you know, again, nothing involving violence or anything like that, but just the kind of thing that was not the way that I was brought up, that kind of mirrored these guys that I worked with at the time, who were all like CEO types, and just kind of live life the way they wanted to live. And they made tons of money and all cheated on their wives and were really bad examples in that way. And I thought, you know, see, these guys get it. You know, that was almost how I saw it. Since I'm now defining success and not letting some decrepit book or religion define what is good for me anymore. Now, whatever I want is good and has value. Just because I want it. And none of your traditional values with your superstitious religion, you know, none of that stuff applies to me. I've outgrown it. Really, looking back, just gross, very self-serving kind of thinking. But also because I had some real hurt there and some things that I didn't know how to resolve. And so I just kind of left them broken and decided that nothing mattered. And with that kind of a worldview, I had to use drugs. It wasn't just I want to. It's I need to, because there's very little meaning there without drugs. Whatever drugs are, they are a spiritual thing in the sense that they grab a hold of you in a way that forces you to worship them. You know, it's like you have a higher power. The higher power is just the molecule, you know. So I lost my job working for some really good people. You know, I would have been set, you know, at least in terms of, you know, what my idea of a successful legal career is, I would have been set working there. I would not have grown in some of the ways that I have, but I really gave up a lot because I was, you know, because I had gone down this path. This is also when I got divorced from my first wife. And that was a very toxic, unhealthy situation. I don't want to spend any time throwing her under the bus because it was mutually destructive. But we used together and drank together. So unhealthy in that way, too. You know, I've heard there's a lot of people that now have come to the conclusion that the opposite of addiction is connection. And so when viewed through that lens, any kind of relationship that is where addiction is a big part of it, there's going to be very little connection. You know, it's like you're kind of in your separate parallel plane. At this point, I'm divorced, don't have my job. And from that point on, I was kind of like a little bit of a nomad. You know, I continued to practice my profession, kept my bar license, you know, by some miracle, but never really anything that had the kind of promise or the level of challenge of the work itself, you know, the kind of litigation that I do and that I was being, you know, trained to do at this firm is difficult. You know, these are lawyers that make a lot of money because the work is hard. And so there were a lot of jobs that I had that the work that I was doing, again, this is my mindset back then, that was beneath me. You know, I was, it was too, it wasn't challenging enough. It didn't pay well enough, you know, and I was nowhere near a point in my life where I had the level of grace and maturity to recognize that this is a paycheck. You know, this is a way to support a family. You know, this time I was just so almost narcissistic, but like a self-loathing narcissist, if that makes any sense. You know, self-centeredness can manifest as I'm the best thing in the world, I'm the only thing in the world. But it can also manifest as I'm the worst thing in the world, I'm the only thing in the world. You know, those two go together, and you see it a lot in alcoholics. And I had that big time. So when this really all started to change was when I met. That's when we've got a big kind of dog leg. I met who I guess I'll describe as the first time I had ever liked a girl this much that liked me back the exact same amount. And I just was head over heels in love with her, but nowhere near ready for a real adult relationship. I was carrying around so much of this stuff. You know, after I think about a year and a half of dating, she finally said, "You are way too sick and unreliable for me to be willing to marry you or be even in any kind of relationship with you." So that was a bad breakup, and I did not handle it well. Alcohol really is starting to replace everything else at this point as the primary thing. So that's when I went to No Longer Bound. No Longer Bound is where I got my God back and my faith. It was like the scales fell from my eyes in so many ways that I couldn't even tell you all the stories. I now believe that God is not something that you can prove to yourself intellectually. God is an experience. You know, God is something that you have to experience. You're not going to prove it with apologetics or with a theorem on a wall. I love that stuff, and I love that stuff to affirm my faith and also to understand my God and my Creator and to learn more about Him. I love those kinds of things. Based on my experience, I didn't find my way to God through that. I found my way to God through brokenness. And I think that the thing that was missing for me or any other Christian who's brought up in the faith and finds that faith tested for the first time, I don't think anyone really grasps Christ and the purpose of the cross until they've experienced brokenness. And I was broken. You know, there's a lot of hospitalizations, you know, mental institutions, hospital stays for infections related to my drug use. My life was exactly where my mindset and my worldview naturally leads. You know, I had followed it to its logical conclusion, and No Longer Bound changed my life. It was not the end of my career as an alcoholic or an addict, although it does represent a point where the true stupidity of drugs, and I alluded briefly to what opiates did after a surgery that I had, and just that kind of, you know, that whole hell that I went into, the folly of all of that and being able to be a father and just really was pretty evident. So I said uncle and surrendered all of that stuff. I even, while I was there, you know, called myself an alcoholic and knew that alcohol was something that I needed to be done with too. I recognized the danger that it represented, not just in and of itself, but also that was for me, the fastest way to fall back into using hard drugs. And of course, my worldview at this point is not compatible with any of those things. There's not even a pretense in my mind that there's anything good that can come out of my continuing to use drugs. So I found God. you know, I believe in the that Christ walked on the earth and that he was the Son of God. Those ideas, again, became preeminent in my mind. I started to get comfortable talking in that kind of language and acknowledging that. Got out of No Longer Bound and it changed her mind about me. You know, the work that I did at No Longer Bound, being committed to such a long-term program, you know, all that stuff got her attention and she was back in my life. Here's where I probably rushed things a little bit. I had an opportunity to take a job at No Longer Bound. It was kind of like a discipleship program that they did, and it paid peanuts, but it paid. And it was a 10-month program that was available to, now it's a year-long program, but it was a 10-month program that was available to recent graduates of the undergraduate program, so to speak. And I was all set to do that. And, you know, they had all these statistics about people that stayed to do the additional 10 months. They had much better long-term success rates. So that was my plan. And then back in the picture, and I had this other option that came out of the blue from a guy that I worked with for a long time, and we really liked each other. Unfortunately, we also love to, you know, hang out and drink beer together. But he's probably my favorite boss slash mentor slash employer that I've ever had. I've learned the most from him in good ways and bad, but this offer came out of nowhere. He had let me go before I went to No Longer Bound. So now I've got waiting for me a job opportunity I never thought I'd have right out of No Longer Bound. I had let my bar license lapse just administratively. I hadn't paid my, it went on inactive status, so I didn't have to pay my bar dues for a few years. I didn't have a driver's license most of the time that I was in No Longer Bound because I had my one and only DUI. And to have this opportunity right out of a treatment center for a year was phenomenal. And I thought at the time, this is obviously God. This is what, you know, God wants me to do. And it would have worked, but I kind of had a role in why it didn't. I think the better, safer, higher percentage shot would have been to stay. I did make the critical mistake of, as we say in AA, I kind of took the steps backwards. And the first thing you do, or kind of the last thing you do as a recovering alcoholic who's taking the steps backwards is physical sobriety. The first step is we came to believe that we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, so you've got two concepts there, unmanageability of my life and powerlessness over alcohol. And for a lot of us, the first time that we get sober and really start to see the good effects of stopping to drink, we start to think, well, wait a second, you know, my life isn't so unmanageable anymore. My life has become manageable. And then kind of the last thing is to decide that, you know, I was just going through a bad time, or in my case, drugs are my problem. I can handle drugs. I can drink like other people. One of the things that our book says is, do you mind if I read a little piece of this? Is such a, there's so much good stuff in here. This is from chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is a first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's just such a great passage. The prose of the book is I love it as someone who likes to read and likes literature. But anyway, the point is, the idea that we can both control and enjoy our drinking is kind of the obsession. And all of us like to think that it'll be different this time. This stuff doesn't apply as much to the drug thing, but with alcohol, it's so pervasive in our culture. And it's just so ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And so it really is a natural thing to wish that, you know, we could drink like other people. And as a general rule, we cannot. It's a progressive illness, meaning that it, even if we haven't had a drink in 20 years, and there's a lot of stories in the book to back this up, people will abstain for 20 years and say, well, I'll drink when I retire. And they retire, out come the carpet slippers, says the book, and the wine glasses, and they start to drink. And within 5 years, they're dead. The progressive nature of the illness is always there. People do not just get over alcoholism, not if they continue to drink. You know, there are a lot of people who figure out that they have to abstain and find ways to do that, that don't involve Alcoholics Anonymous. I strongly, obviously, advocate for the 12-step program because I think it does a lot more for you than just show you how to stop drinking. I don't know if you know this, but the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous come from an old group called the Oxford Group. They had 6 steps, and they didn't call them steps. They called them absolutes, I think. They had a different word for them. So this was a Christian group that healed people that had all different kinds of problems. Alcoholism was just one of them. But the founders of AA borrowed heavily from the 6 steps in the Oxford Group. And all that stuff comes directly from the book of James, 1 Corinthians, Hebrews, as well as the Sermon on the Mount. All the concepts that are in there, the idea of servant leadership, the idea of, you know, love being the overwhelming power of the universe, and that to put others first is the best thing that I can do for me, is a concept that is, I mean, that's straight up Sermon on the Mount, you know. That stuff all came from Christ and was revolutionary at the time, by the way. People forget that. Where was I going with all that? So if you were to distill my story into its, like, you know, if my story was the telephone line, you've got the wires and you got the poles. The poles are, I'm 18, church implodes, lose my friends. The next big poll is, you know, college and law school, early marriage. Next poll is losing the baby and, you know, chucking everything that I believed in my whole life. Kind of the next poll is me handling the divorce, meeting and kind of losing everything for the first time. So I've come out of No Longer Bound. I have married dangerously. I have decided that I'm no longer powerless over alcohol, that my life is no longer unmanageable. So I'm headed for trouble, although I don't know it at this time.
Part 2 of this conversation is on episode 8 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening.